then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's August the 4th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
Okay, guess what the first item of discussion is going to be this week? Yep. Anders Breivik. Now, there's been a ton of stuff on the internet over the past week about Breivik, although I noticed that the story is already starting to slide off the front pages, or I should say off the front web pages. Now, my guess is that the word is out in the left liberal media that Breivik is to be considered what newspapers used to call a 9-day wonder, or as Andy Warhol said, everybody gets to be famous for 15 minutes. It's kind of hard to completely ignore a guy who stacks up bodies like cordwood, but I suspect Breivik's 15 minutes is pretty much up. From now on, we're not going to hear much about him outside Norway itself, and of course whatever media coverage he gets in Norway will be strictly controlled. The latest media reports are that he's sitting in his cell demanding to be given command of an army division and demanding Japanese psychiatrists for his legal examination, so the system is obviously going with the insanity narrative. If Breivik is indeed saying these things, it's probably due to the drugs he's being injected with to make damn good ensure he's crazy by the time he's brought out in public. My guess is that in a few months' time, Breivik will appear briefly in court to plead guilty, and then he will disappear forever. Sometime later, he will be found hanging in his cell, never having uttered one single word in public. This may even happen before his court appearance if it doesn't look like they can fill him up with enough crazy juice to control the narrative. There will be a few media stories at the time of his conviction and at the time of his death, recapping events, but without any contact or interviews with Breivik himself. I would be willing to bet that Anders Breivik is never once allowed to speak openly. Europe does not dare let him do so. Regardless of his motives, be they Zionist, neoconservative, whatever, the fact is that Breivik struck a blow at the real enemy, the left-wing and liberal establishment that has turned all of Europe into a Moroccan Casbah. And regardless of his ideological orientation, the political and financial establishment in every European country are scared shitless that other disenfranchised and dispossessed white males will somehow be able to get hold of a gun. Or worse yet, a group of them may get hold of guns and start acting in an organized manner to remove them from power. Now, Europe does have a fairly recent history of that kind of thing, you know. Some people from our community are still saying that this is all some kind of deep and intricate Jew plot to get the establishment to use the law to take away European white people's rights. But what rights? Except in a few of the Eastern countries, white people effectively have no more rights in Europe. The gun laws in Europe couldn't get much more tight. In every country except Switzerland, gun ownership is for all practical purposes forbidden. In Ireland, for example, the gun laws are very simple. You can have a howitzer on your lawn if you want, as long as you have a permit for it. The Gardaí, the Irish police, are in charge of issuing permits, and they just don't issue any. Period. End of story. to get a privately held handgun permit in Ireland, you have to... Well, I don't know what you have to do. In my almost 30 years of familiarity with the country, I never heard of anyone in the Republic ever getting a permit from the guards for a pistol. And in the North, they're only issued to the most prominent of Unionist politicians, who are virtually certain to be on an IRA hit list, to the point where it would be really embarrassing and blatant if they were refused. Of course, back during the Troubles, we all saw how effective gun control laws were in containing the provosts. In virtually every European country, it is a crime punishable by many years in prison to deny the so-called Holocaust. In fact, in France, it's also worth years of prison time to quote-unquote trivialize the Holocaust, or to deny and try to trivialize the Armenian Holocaust of 1915, which is interesting. France is the only place that legally recognizes two Holocausts, although the Armenians and the Gypsies and the Faggots have been trying to gain official recognition for their Holocausts elsewhere in Europe for years. Any discussion of race and any protest against the massive and unchecked third world immigration is a prosecutable offense anywhere in the EU. So I ask again, what rights was Anders Breivik supposed to be deployed, as the LaRouche term goes, to take away from white Europeans? Despite all the hoopla, I still think this was exactly what it looks like. An ideologically confused white male who'd finally had enough of seeing his country turned into a toilet full of walking brown turds, and who, through some freak accident of heredity, still had the old Aryan Alpha gene in his makeup. And so one day he laid aside his computer keyboard and picked up a weapon, like white men once did for millennia. I know we specialize in conspiracy theory, but if you'll pardon me for quoting the Jew Sigmund Freud, guys, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Or better yet, Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is usually the correct one. Now, I got an email from one of our comrades who lives in Norway on the subject of Anders Breivik. We actually have some fans of my novels in the NF in Scandinavia, and one of the reasons I sent out that email asking for details right away after I heard about the shootings was to try and get a name on the shooter as soon as they released it. I always do that, by the way. Every time a white man or anybody flips out, I try to find out who he is and make sure he's not on the mailing list. Trouble is, sometimes he is, as witness John Hinckley. Anyway, I think this email from our Norwegian comrade might shed some light on the Breivik situation. Now, I won't give this guy's real name, for obvious reasons, and I've cleaned up his English a bit. Dear Harold, I know that many in America are probably upset about the Breivik affair, and I have heard the comments some have made about him allegedly killing all those beautiful blonde white youth myself. The people who are saying this are clearly Americans and clearly do not understand anything about Europe or politics in Norway. We who live here in Norway understand why Breivik selected the targets he did. The Labour Party has been running Norway for several generations now and is responsible for establishing the welfare state and also for open immigration, which has brought hundreds of thousands of colored third world immigrants into Norway, immigrants who have brought with them drugs and crime and filth, and who are destroying our country and our people. There was a case recently where a young Norwegian girl, age 14, was driven to take her own life because she was raped by a gang of Moroccans on more than one occasion, and no one would listen to her or do anything about it. The Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, personally ordered that the police close the investigation and seal the files, and pressured the media into not covering the story because he feared the political repercussions for his party. This is the man Anders Breivik tried to assassinate, and there are many Norwegians who secretly wish that he had succeeded. Many of us here also secretly wish he had killed Gro Brundtland as well, because it was her policies when she was Prime Minister that began the massive influx of asylum seekers. As to Breivik's killing a lot of innocent Nordic youth at the Labour Party picnic, according to the casualty lists published here, at least half of the victims on, well, that island, I can't pronounce that, at least half of the dead on the island were either Muslims or other third world people. But even the white ones, as well, are far from innocent. These were all students who were involved with the Labour Party because they were leftists, or more likely because they simply wanted to get good jobs working for the socialist government, and so they were there at the youth camp to kiss the ass of politicians like Brundtland and get noticed by people with power and money to give them. It is a fair bet that few, if any, of those young people would have had any racial awareness or pride, and had they lived, they probably would have ended up doing harm to Norway. I know in America what Anders Breivik did may be hard to understand, but here in Norway, where we have to live with the Labour Party and what it has done to our country, we get it. No one is willing to say so in public, of course, but we get it. Okay, time for our ladies to speak.
Cleaning up after black stupidity is not just a labor of love for liberals, it's a vitally important industry with millions of dollars at stake. Taxpayer dollars. We just had a massive example of that in the virtually all-black Atlanta public school system. Teachers in Atlanta spent nights huddled in a back room erasing wrong answers on students' test sheets and filling in the correct bubbles. At another school, struggling students, which I think means really dumb niggers, were seated next to higher-performing white classmates so they could copy answers. Those and other confessions are contained in a new state report that reveals how far some Atlanta public schools went to raise test scores in the nation's largest-ever cheating scandal. Investigators concluded that nearly half the city's schools allowed the cheating to go unchecked for as long as a decade, beginning in 2001. Administrators, pressured to maintain high scores under the federal No Child Left Behind law, punished or fired those who reported anything amiss and created a culture of fear, intimidation, and retaliation, according to the report released earlier this month, 2 years after officials noticed a suspicious spike in some scores. The report names 178 teachers and principals, and 82 of those confessed. Tens of thousands of black children at the 44 schools, most in the city's poorest neighborhoods, were allowed to advance to higher grades even though they didn't know basic concepts. For teachers and their bosses, the stakes were high. Schools that perform poorly and fail to meet certain benchmarks under the federal law can face sharp sanctions. They may be forced to offer extra tutoring, allow parents to transfer children to better schools, or fire teachers and administrators who don't pass muster. Basically, No Child Left Behind was an attempt on the part of conservatives back in the George W. Bush days to compel teachers actually to teach something and make the public education system something besides a black hole down which to pour endless streams of money, and the liberal Democrats can't stand it. Neither can the present system produce educated Negroes. No one can. The best teachers in the world can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, not even with millions of dollars at stake. So you see the problem. In essence, the government was asking the school system to do something that can't be done, and threatening to withhold their pay if they didn't do it. Yeah, sounds like the U.S. government to me. In Georgia, teachers complained to investigators that some students arrived at middle school reading at a first grade level. But, they said, principals insisted those students had to pass their standardized tests because their black asses were on the line. One principal forced a teacher to crawl under a desk during a faculty meeting because her test scores were low. Another principal told teachers that Walmart is hiring and the door swings both ways, the report said. Another principal told a teacher on her first day that the school did whatever was necessary to meet testing benchmarks, even if that meant breaking the rules. Needless to say, in all of the media coverage of this scandal, the entire issue of race is never mentioned at all, even though the entire country knows who lives in Atlanta and who staffs the Atlanta public school system. In the second place, the blame is subtly shifted to some outside party, in this case mean old principals and beyond them mean old Republicans, and the mostly black and female teachers are subtly relieved of blame for lying and stealing from the government. Now, what they're angling for, and I wouldn't be surprised to see something like this come out of this scandal, is for the states to drop all testing, period, so that blacks do not consistently score lower than whites and feel bad about themselves. Mark my words, people, that's what is coming here. You have to bear in mind that blacks and liberals do not and have never wanted equality of opportunity. What they want is equality of results, and the only way they can ever achieve that is to cheat.
And now here's Gretchen the Librarian with another book review.
Good evening, comrades. This week, I'm doing a report on Kyle Bristow's book, White Apocalypse. This is a thriller that is also a crash course in European history, and it deals with the Solutrean hypothesis, which is a theory that ancient Caucasians came to America before the Indians. And it is also a book that deals with the issue of the Native American Graves Repatriation Act, which is a government act that says that any pre-Columbian remains are presumed to be Native American. This topic of Graves' repatriation also dealt with in a book called No Bone Unturned by Jeff Benedict. I would also recommend that book, although it is not specifically Solutrean, but it can also give you background on that topic on court cases that have dealt with this issue. This is a theory that has been around for some time. Actually, there are a number of YouTube videos on this topic. And there is evidence for it, not only Kenwick Man, but there's even better evidence than those remains. There's the Spirit Cave mummies, and then there's the haploid X, which is a haploid group that is found mainly in Europe, but is also found in very low quantities in Native Americans. I also think that the Spirit Cave mummies are very good evidence because they're very well preserved and they actually have red hair. And there are even Native American stories about them and how a Native American tribe in the far west fought with them. Now, I've always been fascinated by the topic of prehistory. And I realize that it is always speculative, much like religion. In my mind, at least, is rather speculative because you take scripture and then you interpret it, and it depends on what you see as important. And it's the same thing with history or prehistory, certainly. You look at the archaeological evidence and you find whatever is in it that is important to you, really. Then you have to speculate. You have to put the story together in some way. And sometimes I wonder if history might be circular. If North America completely collapsed economically and all the infrastructure was not maintained. And certainly I've watched that show, The Earth Without Us, and how infrastructure would just collapse over time. And I think, well, if the people of North America went back to hunter-gathering and were constantly exposed to the elements and were therefore subject to natural selection, if Caucasians survived somewhere else, they might come back and say, well, there are Indians here in North America or throughout the Americas. So at any rate, I think this theory is fascinating, and certainly read Kyle Bristow's book if you would like, but realize that it is very frightening in the sense that it has a lot of violence in it, so I'm just going to warn you of that. But really, all of the speculation about the past, what good is it? I mean, we tend to be so oriented towards the past. Sometimes I wonder, what's the point of that? Maybe we waste too much time being sort of stuck in the past. So good evening, comrades, and thank you for listening.
Okay, Gretchen, honey, you're doing it again. You are allowing the liberals to set the parameters of discussion. You are allowing them to dictate to you what you say and thereby what you think. You're using politically correct terminology like Native American when what you mean is Indian. Gretchen, you were born in Connecticut and I was born in North Carolina, both of which states, last time I checked, are in America. That means that both you and I are Native Americans. Folks, really, if you allow the liberals and leftists and Jews to dictate to you what terms you use in your speech, you will eventually find yourselves thinking in those terms, which is what they want to happen. Political correctness is largely about mind control. Don't let them do it to you. Okay, I got a letter from one of our comrades complaining that I've been playing too much banjo and Johnny Reb nigger songs and general southern and hillbilly music on here. And some of our people who don't share my southern background may find this boring and offensive. Also, the medieval music, according to this guy, is too egghead and too slow and sounds weird. So why can't I just play nothing but Ian Stewart? Okay, I made that last bit up, but basically I think that was the gist of it. Fair enough. We won't have any Southern or country music on this show. We'll have all Irish. This is the Bothy Band. only at this point in the show, due to that stupid FCC order we got demanding that we have minority community representation on here, we would have that god-awful African-American news and views segment with Dry Ice Washington. Trouble is, I can't find him. I went over to the bus station in Seattle this morning, but he wasn't on his usual bench where I find him passed out. I have no idea where he's got to, and frankly, I don't have the time or the inclination to be chasing some useless old nigger all over town. So instead, we're going to fulfill our weekly diversity requirement with an African-American culture clip that I stole off NPR.
Oh, good morning, J.R.
Good morning. Who we got in the studio today?
Studio B, Blind Melon Chitlin.
Blind Melon Chitlin, isn't that new British rock group?
Oh, no, J.R., that's the old blues singer that you signed the other day, remember?
Oh, yeah, that's the one we gave the $10 the bottle of booze and the hooker to, huh?
That's the one, J.R.
Yeah, well, let's get going. I feel like solid gold already.
Right you are.
Is that him in the studio?
That's him.
All right, Mr. Chitlin! He ain't deaf, too, is he?
No, Jerry. You have to push the switch forward.
Oh, yeah, hey, I know. I just want to see if you knew. Listen, Mr. Chitlin, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, baby. Hey, listen, Mr. Chitlin, can I call you by your first name?
Yeah.
All right. Listen, now, Blind Baby, what we want to go for on this record is not just a blues record, but we want a document. An epic document depicting the struggle of the black people against the white devil slave masters. You got that? You got us? What the... What's the drummer's name? Johnny? Want to give him a push there? Step on that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chitlin, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, blind baby. Pay a little more attention now, huh?
Yeah.
All right. So we want to start from the top, blind baby, and really cook, honey. All right, ready?
Yeah.
All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, hit it. Oh, cut. Johnny, want to find him his harmonica? Yeah, that's it. Put it in his hand there. Okay, blind baby, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, let's try it with a harmonica this time, okay, honey?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take it from four and really burn, all right?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, cook!
Oh, ding-dong.
Hold it! Cut. Now listen, blind baby, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, listen, what we want is a little more enunciating. The kids today are hung up on the lyrics. They like to listen to the words. I don't know why. But listen, baby, a little more enunciating, okay? We want a little bit more clear. You got that, baby?
Yeah.
All right, let's take it from the top now. Ready? 1, 2, 3, 4, hit it! Cut. Blind baby. The thumping's coming through. So, hey, listen, can we get him to take off his shoes or something?
He already has his shoes off, J.R.
Look like rubber boots to me. Okay, never mind, blind baby. All right, let's take it from the top again. Ready? 1, 2, 3, 4, burn!
Go down, go to see my game.
Yeah, I guess you can get a death ring out of it.
Go down, go to see my girl, y'all.
Yeah, that little natural rhythm's going right in.
Listen. Gonna sing a song, y'all. I'm gonna show my ding-dong.
Hey, stop! Cut! A blind baby, listen, I'm not too clear on the lyrics there that you just used, so let's go back, huh? Maybe it's my fault. Listen, I'll read you what I got, okay? Going downtown, gonna see my gal, gonna sing her a song, gonna show her my ding-dong. That's right, ding-dong. Blind baby, what the hell's this ding-dong?
I think he's gonna show you, J.R.
All right, I'll show you.
Oh my God!
Oh, Jesus Christ, will you look at the size of that thing? Hey, we'll never get that on the album cover. Probably play jump rope with it, though.
Okay, we got an email now from Alaska Mike, who lives in Idaho, which is why we call him Alaska Mike. Don't ask. Dear HAC, for decades, we've been hearing about how the Social Security system will run out of money in 2029 or some such far-off date. Now they're getting worried about getting the August checks if the Republic cruds don't agree to keep giving money to the niggas, i.e. raising the debt ceiling. So, are the Democrats trying to panic the citizenry? Or have the politicals actually given the money to the MUDs, the Israelis, etc.? Either way, something's rotten in Denmark. Inquiring minds want to know, signed Alaska Mike. Okay, as you know, Dry Ice Washington has already commented on the debt ceiling thing a couple of weeks ago, and his comments made as much sense, if not more, than all of the millions of words written and spoken on the subject. Because it's been ongoing, I haven't bothered to say anything over the past couple of weeks about it, but okay, here's my take on it. Now, you might call this debt ceiling for dummies. The official story is that if the Democrats aren't allowed to raise the legal limit on U.S. borrowing, then the government will default on its debts, which in this case means all the money that the U.S. government owes to the Jew banks that they've already borrowed. Obongo, or rather the Jews running him, were at one point threatening to cut off Social Security checks for August, because obviously we have to pay the Shylocks before we pay all those old white people. They were also threatening to cut off military paychecks, this kind of stuff. Stop the tape, as Rush Limbaugh would say. First off, there would have been no default. No Social Security checks would have been withheld unless Obongo really did lose what passes for his mulatto mind. You see, it would have been completely unnecessary. The United States of America takes in an estimated $200 billion in revenue every month, even in these depressed conditions. So if any essential programs did go short, it would have been because the Democrats did it deliberately by giving priority to interest payments to Jewish banks and various Wall Street speculators and whatnot who hold the United States debt over the people of this country. That's their choice, not a default. Of course, it's a choice the Democrats are quite capable of making. Another thing the Jews like Cass Sunstein, who were running Barry, wanted was to postpone the next deadline for the debt ceiling to beyond the 2012 election, because they didn't want to have to deal with the consequences of their policies and their incompetence in an election year. Anyway, they seem to have struck a deal now, which involves no tax increases. So the Republicans are all yelling, "Yay!" Now, you didn't seriously think that either party was ever going to really tax rich people, did you? So, what's it all about? Okay, here's the Cliff's Notes version. This country is broke because successive regimes have spent more than they earned year after year. Billy Boy Clinton managed to work up a paper surplus as recently as 1999, but then Juggiers came along and blew it all on his attempt at world conquest in the 2000s, which military adventures are still with us and draining funds like grain out of a sack with a hole in it. Both Democrats and Republicans made up for the shortfall between revenue and expenditure in three ways: by issuing more bonds or IOUs called T-bills, by borrowing money directly from Jewish banks, and also by having the Jewish Federal Reserve print more money, or in this case, probably they didn't even actually print the physical paper, just created it on computer databases with a few clicks of a mouse. And this is called quantitative easing. And yes, I know this is all grossly oversimplified. Now, the country is suffering something like 22% real unemployment once the government's fantasized figures are tossed aside. Tax revenue is dropping like a stone because unemployed people can't pay withholding taxes via W-2s, and people whose homes have been foreclosed on can't pay property taxes to support state and local governments. So the whole ball of wax is finally starting to come unglued. This, by the way, is that window of opportunity for the Northwest Front that I keep on talking about. The only thing holding America together right now is unearned money, either borrowed or printed. Obongo and the Democrats desperately needed congressional permission to borrow more, because if they can't get it, they'll either have to print more money or, what's worse, cut spending. And the only way the Democrats can stay in power is by bribing their various constituencies like niggers and illegal wetbacks and unions and whatnot with taxpayer dollars. Now, I suppose that borrowing more money is a marginally better solution than simply having Ben Bernanke over at the Federal Reserve tap on his keyboard and print more money. But either way, the regime is still spending billions more dollars every month than it takes in. And common sense ought to tell everybody that at some point in time, it's all going to come crashing down. A few Republicans, Tea Party types, plus I think some of them who simply just have a few brain cells to rub together, finally have awakened to the fact that the country can't live on a credit card forever. And at some point, the madness has to stop. They were sufficiently numerous to raise enough hell for a time there to stop the rhinos, the Republicans in name only, from groveling before Obongo and just giving in as they normally would do, since they're just as much in the pockets of the Jew banks as the Democrats are, if not more so. Congress performed this whole dog and pony show over the past few weeks, and then at the 11th hour, the rhinos caved and bowed down to Barry and his Jewish handlers like Sunstein and Bernanke. Now the Republicans can go back to the white voters that they've just buggered without benefit of Vaseline and claim that they did everything they could. But that mean old mungoid in the White House just wouldn't budge, so they just had to surrender for the country's sake, yada, yada, yada. Of course, the question of what happens in the long run, like when at long last the credit card runs dry, will be comfortably put off until 2013. Whatever's left of the country can deal with it then. Until at some point, things get so ridiculous that even the mighty U.S. of A. can't find anybody who's willing to lend any more money. In which case, the Jew Bernanke gets to fire up those printing presses and we have Weimar Republic-style inflation. Groovy. Okay, now, last week I mentioned the British National Party and Nick Griffin. Now, I said what I had to say then about Griffin, but it occurred to me that many of you folks have not actually heard of old man Tyndall, the guy who founded the BNP around 1980 or so. I found this clip of John Tyndall back in his heyday with the National Front in the 1970s. He's doing an interview here with some BBC reporter or somebody, and the reporter sets a trap for him, which he manages to sidestep, but this is a very common trap that the media likes to set for us, and if you're ever going to be doing media interviews yourselves, you need to kind of be aware of this and figure out some way to deal with it. Now, see if you can spot in this clip what that trap is, and I will discuss this in the third segment of the show.
The left failed to stop the march in Leicester 12 days ago, and the front claimed it as a victory. At a meeting later that day, they looked ahead to their next march in London this coming Saturday.
They say that they'll stop us in London in 2 weeks' time. And, my friends, we all know, once again, they are going to fail. But these are the people in front of whom all the forces of the establishment, all the forces of respectability and authority, have for the past 10 or 20 years been retreating like craven cowards and craven fools.
John Tyndall is chairman of the National Front. He claims that the party is growing, but he won't reveal its total membership.
And now there has risen a force representing the will of the British people to be great again, which has proved time and time again, and will prove time and time again in the days and the years to come, that come all the red mobs, come all the threats, come all the violence, come all the insults, we will keep marching on and they will outcome us!
Despite the tragedy of Red Lion Square, the National Front policy is to keep on marching.
We have a completely clear conscience on these matters. No violence has been organized or promoted by us. Our members are never or almost never arrested. The disorder is promoted entirely by our opponents of the left wing, and we are not going to be stopped carrying out our right of free speech and free assembly by threats from the left wing.
But if the authorities came to you, Mr. Tyndall, and said, please, in the interests of law and order, do not march on Saturday, what would you say?
If the authorities come to us and order us as an instruction not to march, then, of course, we shall have to obey the law. If they merely ask us advise us not to march, then I'm afraid, no, we shall go ahead and march.
Many of your views, of course, have remained the same.
Some of my views have remained the same, yes. I was always very patriotic, always a nationalist, and those views remain the same.
The National Front expresses its policy on immigration in this way. The repatriation by the most humane means possible of those coloured immigrants already here, together with their descendants and dependents. Your policy is to send them home.
To send them home where possible, or at least to resettle them, if there's not an immediate home available, to resettle them somewhere in the world.
You see, to so many immigrants, this is home.
Well, it may be, but that is not what is regarded by the majority of the population.
You talk of compensation, do you see, but what happens when money fails to persuade the family to go
Well, we have made it perfectly clear that this is going to be something obligatory. It has to be.
You see, what sort of compulsion could you use? How can you make
the normal compulsion that you exercise when you deport anybody. There are all sorts of parallels in recent history. Large numbers of Palestinian and Palestinian Arabs were uprooted from their homes in the Middle East. Huge numbers of Germans were uprooted from their homes in what is now, what used to be Germany, what is now Poland. There have been cases of people in China, Tibetans and so on. There are all sorts of cases of people that have had to be resettled by far more brutal means than we advocate applying to the immigrants in this country, which I think are eminently fair.
But you wouldn't suggest methods. That any of the three examples that you've just mentioned were ideal solutions?
No, certainly
problem?
Not. But they do at least show that these things can, this resettlement, can be accomplished over a over a space of time.
You must see the practical problems here. You must, it must, if you're serious about this policy, you must see that it is going to cause untold suffering
and
hardship and
anguish.
Of course
I see the practical problems. Of course I see, and I've said to you, that it could cause suffering. You say untold suffering. I only say that there is going to be more suffering in the future if the problem is not tackled.
When you're in power, will you frown on mixed marriages?
Yes, we're not in favor of mixed marriages.
How would you discourage them?
Well, that isn't something that we've come to any conclusions about at the moment. There are not an enormous number of mixed marriages in this country at the present time, and we would attempt to educate people into an understanding of the bad consequences of mixed marriages.
But at school level and...
Yes, if necessary.
Do you believe that the white man is ethnically superior?
Yes, undoubtedly. I'm not talking about the white man in relation to the, for instance, the Japanese or the Chinese, but I'm talking about the white man in relation to the Negro. And I think that the whole of what has happened in Africa since the white man left, or he nearly left, has borne out this.
Do you think that you're going to see the day when the National Front forms a government in this country?
I don't just think, I'm sure of it.
When we go into the coming election, we are going to say this to the people. You have had 30 years of incompetent government. We've had 30 years of incompetence. We've had 30 years of ineptitude. We've had 30 years of pathetic leadership. We've seen one of the greatest countries in the world dragged down so that it's now the poor sick man of Europe. This is the record of the old parties. This is the record of the little men who are now standing up and saying to the people, oh, don't take any notice of these extremists. Stand with us to preserve the system. The National Front and those extremists, we've got to stop them. What they're saying to you, ladies and gentlemen, is give us another 30 years to finish the job of Britain. They've tried to stop us at Leicester. They've tried and they've failed. They say that they'll stop us in London. And, my friends, we all know, once again, they are going to fail. Come all the red mobs, come all the threats, come all the violence, come all the insults. We will keep marching on, and they will stop us!
Okay, as I said, since apparently I've been playing too much country and western, too much banjo and whatnot, and generally comporting myself in the manner of a musical redneck, this week we're going to have all Irish. This is Planxty.
His eye. Then up woke Johnny from out of his sleep, and so blind me. And he's leaned his back against the knoll, his foot against a stone, and he has fired on the seven foresters. He's killed them all but one, and he's broken seven of this man's ribs, his arm and his collarbone, and he has set him unto his horse to bring the tidings. His two grey dogs are slain, and his body lies in Monymusk, and his hunting days are done.
Speaking of things British, quick question for you guys out in the audience who are up to speed on various bits and pieces of esoteric right-wing knowledge. Was the late English anti-Jewish writer and pamphleteer Arnold Leese ever actually recorded in an interview or in any other way? If so, are there any MP3s out there floating around that I could glom onto for this show? I know Leese died in 1956, and that's recently enough so he may have left some recorded audio testimony behind. I've never heard him speak, and I'm sure that anything he did record would be worth hearing. Okay now, did you spot the trap that the British TV interviewer was trying to lure John Tyndall into? The bit where he attempted to trick or maneuver Tyndall into some statement that appeared to endorse violence or illegality as a National Front policy. They used to try and do that to me all the time back in the 70s and the 80s when I was having my own 15 minutes. Hopefully, someday, some of you listening to this will be in some kind of leadership position, and you'll be doing your own media interviews, and you'll need to learn how to avoid this ambush. The interviewer kept pushing Tyndall on this subject of, if the National Front comes to power, what are you going to do to certain people? I think you can all tell what he was hoping for. He was trying to get Tyndall to make some kind of utterance that could be taken as an official policy statement or statement of intention on the part of the organization, that at some point in the future they intend to use violence or illegality against poor defenseless little non-whites or poor defenseless little shirtlifters and Irish bandits or whatever. The one thing that you must never, ever do is to respond to this kind of question in public by losing your cool or trying to be cool or trying to be funny. Or trying to blow it off with some kind of comment like, what the hell do you think we're going to do with them? We're going to shoot them in the head and then grind up their bodies into fertilizer. Or, actually, we're going to eat all the little Mexican babies for breakfast. Or nothing like that. Even if you mean it as a joke or a flip answer, you must never ever say anything of the kind because it will stick with you for the rest of your life. The media will make sure of that. Not even in jest. You need to understand something very clearly. We are not allowed a sense of humor by the media, nor are we allowed a sense of hyperbole or hyperbole. I don't know how to pronounce that word because I've never had to say it out loud before. I've only written it. Anyway, neither are we allowed irony or sarcasm. You yourself might get that an answer you give is intended to be funny or intended to be ironic. I'd get it. Anyone with two brain cells might get that you weren't serious. Even the government itself will understand perfectly well that you're not serious. but when it suits their purposes, they will pretend to take it seriously. We don't have the right to be funny or ironic. Always remember that anything you say regarding the subject of violence or illegality will be treated dead seriously, and it can and will be used against you in a court of law if the regime finds it expedient to do so. Now, over the past few years, this has become more dangerous than it sounds. The television reporter who interviewed John Tyndall in that clip was not just trying to get a soundbite for his show. He was working to an agenda, and he was attempting to do harm to Tyndall and the National Front, which is, of course, completely unprofessional, but this is what the media does. The media and their journalists are not in any way objective. They have no desire to report the news accurately or fairly, and they are never, ever your friends. If they pretend to be your friends, or if they pretend to be sympathetic, watch out. There's a knife in their pocket intended for your back. You will notice how carefully Tyndall danced around the question and avoided answering directly, and he wasn't just being a typical slippery politician who doesn't want to give a straight answer. This was important, especially in Europe, where parties have been legally banned and individuals sent to prison for forgetting themselves and forgetting where they are and thinking that they have some kind of right to freedom of speech. Now, this was back in the 1970s in Europe, but let's fast forward to 2011. It used to be that we had a kind of arrangement with the Justice Department and the FBI, which back in the day was the only secret police agency that really dealt with us. Now we've got about six alphabet soup agencies that are wiretapping us and following us around and trying to insert spies into our little groups out in the garage, so forth and so on. Anyway, the arrangement we more or less had back in the 60s and the 70s was that we could get together out in the cow pasture rallies and rant and rave about killing niggers all we wanted. A couple of dozen of us could get together and walk down the street surrounded by 500 police and 2,000 scumbags who yelled and screamed so loud that it didn't make any difference what we said through the bullhorn because nobody could hear us. And as long as we didn't actually do anything physical to act on our principles, we would be kindly allowed to continue on rallying in cow pastures and walking down the street. Above all, we could write whatever we wanted and nobody would be actually harmed because they knew that no one would read what we wrote. About once every 5 or 6 years, there might be somebody the regime decided was getting a little too popular and dangerous. For example, Bob Miles, Bob Depew, Leroy Gibson, the Gerhardt brothers, and so forth back in the early 70s. And so the FBI would do a frame-up, traditionally involving an informer and a paraffin test, which was their fabrication method of choice back then in the days before digital audio and the Patriot Act. And they'd send the targeted individual away for 5 or 6 years, not 70 years like they're threatening 66-year-old Edgar Seal with. It was their way of reminding us every now and then who was boss, but in those days they weren't afraid of us. There was no chance that we might actually do any harm to their wealth and their power, and everybody knew it. Now today, things are different. Today, for one thing, we have multiple secret police and government agencies scrambling for federal budget, about six of them clamoring for slices from the pie that was once divided up about 80-20 between FBI and ATF, and that was that. Now there are at least half a dozen nasty little government piglets sucking on the taxpayer teat, more if you count state agencies trying to get their snout in the trough, and the pie itself really hasn't gotten any bigger, pardon all the mixed metaphors. Doing harm to white nationalists in any way is a very good way to get a little gold star on your forehead from D.C. and get oodles more budget for your agency. The FBI office in Spokane is going to be eating steak and lobster off the bionic backpack incident for a couple of years, more if they can find somebody to frame as being the mysterious second man. I got a hint for you guys, it was Harry Lime. Now, for another thing, these days the regime really is afraid of us, and with reason. I've always been astounded by the fact that our enemies seem to have a far greater grasp of our potential than we ourselves do. Today, white Americans are being arrested and sent to prison for things that they write, specifically things that they post to the internet, because there's always a chance that somebody besides the usual little overlapping mailing list of a couple of thousand names might read what we write. The regime is using the excuse that writers and commentators they wish to suppress are allegedly threatening somebody as a legal fig leaf to cover the fact that they've decided to nullify the First Amendment. And sometimes even that doesn't work, as in the Bill White case. Yeah, he eventually got all his cases thrown out, But he also spent 2.5 years in prison while it was ongoing, so I think that's a price most of us don't want to pay. However, the fact remains that the whole concept of a quote-unquote credible threat has now been twisted like a pretzel out of all recognition. One of the charges they got Bill White on was when he got into a dispute with some real estate agency and sent them a nasty email. And at his trial, they had some nigger girl from the office get up on the stand and say, "Oh, when I read that email from that nasty racist man, Bill White, I felt so apprehensive and I was in fear of my life." In other words, anybody who claims that you scared them can now have you arrested and sent to prison, no matter how ridiculous the circumstances, if you happen to be somebody the regime wants to put away for political reasons. Now, all this baloney is leading up to something that the establishment in this country has wanted to bring into our law for a long time, with a lot of encouragement and egging on from outfits like the ADL and the SPLC. And it's something that they've already gotten onto the statute books in some European countries, i.e. criminalizing the so-called infliction of mental and emotional anguish. Yes, in some countries, you can be sent to prison for hurting somebody's feelings. Again, assuming that you're not a member of a politically protected minority, and you're somebody the local Zog wants to put away just on general principles. You must never, ever verbally state that you or your organization intend anything illegal or violent, whatever your genuine intentions may be. You need to be very, very careful about anything you say when there are media reporters or TV cameras within earshot. Now, for various reasons, the regime prefers to bring these bullshit charges on the basis of verbal utterances. Although sometimes, as in Bill White's case, they do make an exception. And yes, I know, Bill White eventually had all 5 of his criminal charges struck down by the courts on constitutional grounds. Possibly because they were dealing with the written word in a clearly political or economic context. Apparently, as nearly as I can gauge their thinking, our lords and masters are still a little bit nervous about trying to prohibit or punish the written word, which is even more clearly protected under the U.S. Constitution than verbal stuff. Also, verbal and audio recorded speech is shorter. It can be reduced to a soundbite, which is what most Americans are accustomed to. It can, if necessary, be altered and fabricated, as it was in the Edgar Steele case. And it sounds more threatening and convincing to today's idiot Beavis and Butthead juries, many of whom can't read effectively. The printed page is impossible to diddle, and even email tampering is pretty easy to detect by someone who knows his computers. I think this is one reason why I haven't been arrested and prosecuted yet for any of my Northwest novels, because logically speaking, if they're going to try and imprison me for writing a book, it would be difficult for the U.S. attorney to block any defense demand that the members of my jury actually sit down and read the entire book, which many of them are incapable of doing, especially the niggers, and which would also provide a context for whatever specific passages or words they were trying to lock me up over. Anyway, guys, you get the idea. If and when you are ever in any kind of position where you are dealing with the media, never trust them and always try to weigh every single word before it comes out of your mouth. Never try to use humor or irony. We don't get that privilege. The media are just as much the enemy as any FBI agent, and they can destroy you just as effectively. Well, I said I wasn't going to be playing any country and western or southern music on here this week, just Irish. But then I remembered that I had this on my hard drive. It's actually a western-type ballad, but it's performed by Planxty with the Irish folk singer Christy Moore. This is True Love Knows No Season.
Billy Gray rode into Gansaree way back in 83. There he first met with a young Sarah McLean. The wild rose of morning, the pale flower of dawning, heralded its springtime in Billy's life that day. reality. In her young eyes, Billy bore not a flaw. No, not her chosen one, he was a hired gun. Then one day a tall man came riding from the badlands that lie to the north of New Mexico. He was overheard to say he was looking for Billy Gray, a wanted man and a dangerous outlaw. Well, the news it came creeping to Billy, fast sleeping there in the Clarendon Bar and Hotel. He ran to the old church that lies on the outskirts, thinking he'd hide in the old steeple there. But a rifle ball came flying face down, he lay dying there in the dust on the road where he lay. Sarah ran to him, she was cursing the lawman. Poor girl knew no reason except that he'd been killed.
Okay, now, having cautioned all of you against making wild and extreme statements about violence and illegality in public, now let's see if I can get myself arrested. The other night, I spoke on the phone with a longtime comrade who told me that he's come up with a corollary to an old saying. It goes like this. If you're not a liberal when you're 20, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative when you're 40, you have no head. And to this, Brother Bill has added, if you're not a total cynic by the time you're 60, you just haven't been paying attention. Right now, pretty much all of white America understands to some degree or another, at some level of their consciousness, that the system and the society we live in is doomed, and that it will eventually collapse. That collapse may be a few years off yet, but for the first time, it's visible on the horizon, even to dumbass people who never paid any attention until recently because they were too busy wallowing like hogs in the luxury trough and roaring off to Six Flags on the weekend. Above all, there is now complete and total cynicism over the entire political process in this country, and a deep and abiding skepticism and disbelief regarding anything to do with Washington, D.C. And I'm not just talking about the Six Flags crowd now. I'm talking about the white minority in this country who still control most of the wealth and power that remains in private hands. The establishment is losing what was once its core base of support, the white upper middle and lower rich classes. Millions of Americans have simply given up on the existing system, and they're just doing their best to avoid any entanglement with it, especially with the courts. There's nothing like an encounter with the American justice system, either as a defendant or as a victim, to complete someone's utter disillusionment with the United States and the corrupt and stupid bastards who run it. To make a long story short, this country and this society have now passed the point of no return. I base that on a lifetime of observation and study of history, human beings, and the way in which various forces and events interact in the real world. Now, I admit, I have no idea how or when it's going to happen, but there's now no doubt in my mind that this world we live in is toast. Now, this, to me, is good news. I was honestly afraid for many years that I would never live to see any real change and that I would end up dying in some old folks' home with a red, white, and blue Masonic dish rag flying over it to the sound of a Brady Bunch rerun going on in the TV room. But now I know that there is at least a chance that I'll live to see this shithole burn and hear these people scream and die, and I'm really looking forward to it. Now, it may not be us who finally kicks over this rotten wall, but it's going to be someone, and it's going to be soon, in the lifetime of most of us listening to this now. I mean it, guys. Everybody now understands that there is only one way that genuine change will be brought about in America, whatever their vision of genuine change may be, and it ain't going to be by pulling a little lever in a booth to keep your state red or blue or make it change colors. Sooner or later, somebody in this country is going to pick up a rifle. And I don't mean some lone whack job like Anders Breivik. I mean some organized group of people who have finally had enough and who decide that they are no longer afraid of the mighty FBI and their badges and their black SUVs and their guns and their SWAT gangs and the body armor. People who decide that they would rather die than live one more day like this. I hope to God that when that happens, they're white. And by the way, the mighty FBI and Homeland Security and the bureaucrats in their cubicles and corner offices in D.C. know this, too. Oh, yeah, they do. Now, without getting into details, I've had some contact recently with some, shall we say, authority figures, and I know others who have as well. And let me tell you, people, our friends in the silk suits are as jumpy as cats on a hot tin roof. They can sense their control over the American people's hearts and minds slipping. They know that the American people, by which I mean white people, are mad as hell, and at some point in time they're going to be pushed one foreclosed home and one outsourced job and one outrageous medical bill and one tax too far, and they're not going to take it anymore. Now, just to recap, as far as any of you who may be contemplating doing an Anders Breivik number, I say to you again, no, please don't do anything of the kind. And no, I'm not just saying that to cover my ass. I'm saying that because individual acts of terrorism don't work, and we need to keep our eyes on the prize. They don't work because Americans don't do symbolism. They're incapable of understanding or appreciating a symbolic act. They're dumbasses with the attention spans of houseflies who simply do not understand the concept of the propaganda of the deed. Joe Stack flew his plane into the IRS building in Austin 2 years ago, and 2 days later, no one remembered his name. All Americans understand is a threat to their wallet and their material wealth and their physical well-being, and right now Obama's America is inflicting just that very thing on them. Finally, they're starting to get it. We don't need isolated massacres by individuals. That's just crime. We need one big massacre by a lot of people acting in concert. That's statecraft. I am not asking you to die for your race. I'm asking you to live for it. And right now, I'm asking you something even harder. I'm asking you to work for it. That's the crux of the whole problem we're facing right now. If we were in a revolutionary situation right now, there's no question in my mind that we would have more Northwest volunteers than we could arm or know what to do with. But we can never reach that revolutionary tipping point because nobody wants to go first and do the heavy lifting. I could find 1,000 men and women among you who would be willing to fight and die for the Northwest Republic. I can't find 10 of you who will work for it. That's what has to change. And I'm going to keep on ranting and raving at you until it does. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha on the Bon. Freedom.